Hello there, I'm Jason Schulman, and this is New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. My guest today on the podcast is Chris Brickle, Associate Professor of Gender Studies and Head of the Department of Sociology, Gender, and Social Work at the University of Otago. He's here to talk about his new book, Teenagers, The Rise of Youth Culture in New Zealand. It's published by Auckland University Press in 2017. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Jason.
It's great to have you on. So, Chris, you say that most general histories of New Zealand focus on adults, and that teens appear only as minor players. Why did you want to write about teenagers in New Zealand?
I think partly because of that, you know. In a sense, we've had a lot of histories in New Zealand of gender and sexuality, a lot of histories of the indigenous Maori people. But young people are a group, very significant group. We all were young once, of course, who really hadn't had a systematic academic and historical treatment. So I thought it was about time, really.
And what's interesting is that the book doesn't, you know, only focus on the 1950s and 60s when we think about kind of the rise of the teenager. You go back into the 19th century. Why did you want to start there?
I think one of the things I'm interested in doing in my own historical research is thinking a little bit about moving back beyond the taken-for-granted kind of era in which a phenomenon is said to take hold, in a sense. So everyone imagines that the teenager is an invention of the 1950s. I was interested in finding out a little bit about the prehistory of that kind of moment. In other words, that period of time, particularly in the 19th century, when we didn't necessarily think there was a lot there to study because young people went straight from their family situation into a work situation, or so we are told, and there was nothing there in terms of a transition, but actually there was. So partly it's my interest in uncovering the history that is not supposed to be there.
So what are some of the similarities and what are some of the differences of the teenager experience in New Zealand versus, you know, the UK, the US, and nearby Australia?
I think New Zealand both has had some similarities and also some differences. So you had a distance from the international kind of currents that were going on in terms of the kind of speed of industrialization, for instance, and the degree of secondary schooling. But there were also some real similarities. New Zealand drew quite heavily, for instance, on the kind of cultural forms, books, newspapers from overseas. So ideas about what it meant to be young kind of percolated in from overseas from the 19th century on. Of course, that became much stronger through the 20th century, with the rise of jazz in the 1920s, for instance, and then rock and roll in the 1950s. But there's actually quite a long history of interconnections between international and New Zealand cultural forms, but also in New Zealand, the geography was somewhat different. So you had a long, skinny country, basically quite mountainous, not as easy to get around as some other countries during particularly the early 20th century. And so you had emerge a bit of a distinction. I don't talk about this that much in the book, but between the young people who lived in the port cities, which were the parts of the country through which sailors, clothing, cultural influences came in. And I do talk about that, but what's less kind of evident, I think, in the book is that, in fact, in those cities that weren't port cities, you didn't have that kind of influence. So in a sense, that the ports were portals through which forms of culture emerged and diffused somewhat differently depending on whether you lived by a port or not. So New Zealand was both kind of particular and also internationally connected, particularly through its port network.
The book proceeds chronologically, so let's start kind of at the beginning. In the 19th century, what was life like for, you know, a teenager in New Zealand? I mean, it seems like the main thing that they would be doing would be work or school. What were those two worlds like?
I think by the 1880s, 1870s and 1880s, you actually had quite different experiences for two different groups of young people. So you had the working class young people who were developing a young people's culture within the factories, which grew quite rapidly through the 1870s and 80s. And so their world was a work world, but a work world in which there were lots of other young people to muck about with. And then you had the middle class and upper middle class young people who were entering into secondary schooling in actually quite rapid numbers through that particular time in the 19th century. And so their daily world was much more structured around the culture of the classroom and extracurricular activities and the kind of fun that they'd have with their schoolmates outside of ours. So you had quite a distinction, I think, between young people from different backgrounds in terms of what their work life would look like. Prior to the 1870s, of course, in New Zealand for young women, they were often tied into domestic service, and so they were quite isolated socially. The factories, therefore, the rise of factory work dramatically changed those young women's lives, often for the better in many ways. So class, I think, very strongly structured young people's lives during the 19th century in particular. In the 20th century, you had increasing numbers of working class young people entering into the secondary school system. And so there was a bit of a convergence by the middle of the 20th century. But certainly class was very important early on.
What about race? What do we know about what was happening with Indigenous Māori teenagers?
So there was very much a rural-urban divide in New Zealand society prior to the middle of the 20th century. Most young Māori lived in the countryside, in rural areas, in villages, and most of the city inhabitants were Pākehā or young people of European descent. And one of the things that was particularly significant about the middle of the 20th century in New Zealand, that the post-war decades in particular, is that there was a very, very rapid urbanisation of young Māori who moved into the cities to take up the trades training schemes and the other kinds of growing factory work and so on. So you had a convergence again of Māori and Pākehā young people's cultures through the 1940s and 50s. But prior to that, the lives of young Māori vis-a-vis young Pākehā were very much structured by that rural-urban split.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting is that then, like today, technology was really important to these young people. You talk about telephones. And then one thing that struck me was you say that the typewriter changed girls' lives dramatically. What was it about technology that made these young people's lives change so drastically?
Well, technology is fascinating, isn't it? It really is a kind of a driver of social change in that way. I mean, the typewriter was so important because it was part of the really rapid rise of clerical work at the start of the 20th century. And so the office and the culture of the office girl really became a thing. In the 19th century, most office clerks were male. By the early 20th century, most office workers were female. And so you actually had a new kind of work life encouraged by the typewriter. Other forms of technology have been really important too, transport technologies in particular. So the advent of the railways in the later part of the 19th century meant that young people could travel around independently over increasing distances. In the 20th century, the rise of the tram system in urban areas made young people's mobility much more ready. You've mentioned the telephone, and by the 1910s, young people were ringing one another up chatting about all sorts of stuff on the phone. So in a way, as you say, we associate teenagers with technology now, particularly the rise of social media, but in many ways young people's lives were very profoundly affected by these forms of technology going right back into the 19th century. So again, that's another example of the kind of historical continuities, I think.
As we get into the 20th century, and especially into the 1920s, the jazz age, you know, a lot of things may be familiar to listeners, some of the movements and some of the things that youth were doing to challenge the norms of society. And yet you say that the jazz age was really a contradictory time for teenagers. Why so?
The 1910s and 20s in New Zealand were really interesting because you had two things going on. You had an increasingly strident moralism coming from more conservative adults, but those kind of social trends like jazz were also kind of really loosening up the kind of loosening the bounds of propriety. And you know, the newspapers reporting in reporting young women's lives in particular in ways meant to scandalise their readers, what they were also doing was revealing the kind of more freer kind of young people's cultures that were taking shape at that time. Again, in terms of young women, you know, this is the period where the corset basically disappears to all intents and purposes, as does the chaperone, and that is replaced by very much freer, more revealing clothing and young people's cultures, which again, interestingly, were being promoted by the churches, the rise of Bible class and scouts and guides and youth groups and so on, in one way, an attempt to perhaps to channel young people's energies in ways considered wholesome. But on the other hand, what those kinds of organisations did was create a real mass movement of young people who were organising together as young people. So there are some really kind of contradictory strands in New Zealand history at that point. One of the most well-known New Zealand historians, James Balich, talks about the time as a time of great tightening, which in some senses was true, but in many other senses totally wasn't. So yeah, you've got both things going on at the same time, which is, I found that quite fascinating to sort of think through.
Tell us a little bit about language. You know, how did young people change the way they speak? How did, you know, you talk a lot about the slang that young people used. How did that change, especially in the 1930s and 1940s?
Okay, so what happened in the 19th century, the slang was very English, and in the early 20th century, so, you know, hard case and ripping and spiffing and all of that kind of stuff that you kind of expect out of the very English young people's magazines. By the 1920s, of course, 1920s, you had the rise of film. Movies were pretty much silent until about 1928. What happened then, of course, were the talkies, the mostly American films with speech, basically. And so what happened then is you have a real diffusion of American slang into New Zealand. And I was interested in words like gee and yeah, words that really came in the 30s as young people were watching American films. So New Zealand, you know, had long imagined itself very much as a kind of a branch of the United Kingdom. But the American cultural kind of influences by the 1930s and 40s were becoming overwhelming. And so young people's language really did take on a more American kind of hue at that point.
And what's really interesting, tell us how you knew that these young people were using words like gee. What kind of archives did you look at?
Okay, so I looked at, I travelled around New Zealand and consulted either directly or indirectly about 50 different libraries and archives. And what I did as I went through young people's diaries is I very much kind of mined them and wrote up lists of the kind of slang terms that were appearing in those kind of diaries. So diaries were the main source for that. There were some newspaper reports, for instance, of young people fighting in the cinemas in Christchurch in Auckland in the 1920s, and those reports would sometimes relay the language that young people were using. But certainly, yeah, letters and diaries where young people are writing in their own language at the time. So in other words, one of the good things about those kind of sources is that when you use oral histories, people are trying to remember back decades. When you use diaries and letters and newspaper reports and things that people have written at the time, you've actually got a clear sense of what words people were using, exactly when they were using them, which meant I could actually go through and work out when the earliest mention of particular terms was, and yeah, G and yeah were very much 1930s words.
The book is full of gorgeous photographs from all the decades, and really, you know, gives a nice kind of pictorial representation of what you're talking about. The book ends in the 1960s, kind of following the kind of famous decade that we think of when we think about kind of teenager life. But in at the very end of the book, you reflect on your own experience as a teenager in the 1980s, I believe. So how did kind of writing the history kind of change or shape the way you thought about your own upbringing?
I think what was interesting is that I could sort of see some of the history of things that were sort of notable to me as a teenager. So things like, you know, that was the era of the sort of death of the typewriter almost and the rise of the Walkman, thinking about how, you know, something like the Walkman, a quintessentially 1980s kind of thing, in a sense was the latest in a long line of technologies and music kind of technologies that went back some kind of way. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? The 1980s, with all its magnificent music and big hair and everything, I mean, to me, that was the era where things became modern. But thinking about it, of course, for everyone growing up in preceding decades, the decades when they became of age were also the decades when things became modern for them. As someone who was a teenager in the 1950s said somewhere, you know, the 1950s were the decade where everything became colourful. And so looking back on my own kind of adolescence and thinking about the way it kind of sat very much in a long historical context, I think I mentioned there somewhere that I had noticed that the socks that we're wearing at school as part of our school uniform were the same as the socks that were worn in the 1910s in New Zealand. And in fact, I read subsequently that our school socks, I think, were the only part of the uniform that went back to 1928 when a high school was formed. So, yeah, it was really interesting just thinking about even some of the little things and how they had a really interesting history, I guess.
Chris, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. That's Chris Brickle. He's from the University of Otago. His new book is Teenagers, The Rise of Youth Culture in New Zealand. It's published by Auckland University Press in 2017. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.